Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another video. Now, a couple of weeks back, I reviewed David Starkey interviewing Jeremy Hunt, and I had to turn it off in disgust. I wondered about doing a part two. I'm not going to do a part two. I cannot put myself through that again. Instead, I thought it would be more interesting to watch David Starkey with somebody who is, in theory, to his right, Connor Tomlinson, and I'm going to review this. I haven't watched it. I'm going to review it. Let's see. I mean, I don't promise getting through the whole hour, but I'm going to give my ongoing commentary here. It's going to be very interesting to see what Starkey is like when put up against somebody, you know, quote unquote, to his right. Let's have a look to see what is discussed. Before we get going, I will remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, Mega Bundle, Trivium, Economics, Politics, many, many great courses available. Buy it now, buy it now. And I take a drag on this part of gas cigar, have a sip of my drink. Let's get going.
I don't think that we should allow Zia Yusuf and Nigel Farage admitting to calling the police on Rupert for bogus reasons to go unpunished. Because I don't think we actually have that much in common if we don't have basic virtues like loyalty and honesty, the sort of the cornerstones of conservative thought that Jonathan Haidt has found in his Moral Foundations. I don't think we can let that go, and I don't think we have much in common if they don't have that in common with us.
I believe that those extraordinary traditions of this weird country, of its ability to balance change and tradition, of its ability to hold together community and individualism, of localism and literally empire, I think they're still there.
Do you think those traditions will still be alive if my generation is majority non-British?
Hello and welcome to David Starkey Talks, and today I am delighted to be talking to Connor Tomlinson. I think the last time we met Connor would have been, we were just talking now about Peter Whittle, would have been at one of his Trafalgar Group meetings, would it?
I think the last time we ran into each other was one of the trigonometry Christmas parties, but the last time we had an extended conversation about the state of British politics was...
Can you imagine going to the trigonometry Christmas party? Bloody hell. My gosh.
Yes, us both trying to get a word in edgewise at one of Peter's meetings, which definitely should be revived.
Yes, agreed. Before we begin, can I just clarify one thing? You are, and clearly have become, very closely associated with somebody I would call a friend, with Rupert Lowe and the new political party Restore. Is the relationship a formal one, or are you... simply a leading member, adherent, apologist, whatever one wants to call it?
I think apologist is probably the best way to put it, actually.
In the good Catholic sense of the word.
Yeah, quite. I'm not necessarily up to Chesterton or Lewis's calibre, though I'll do my best. I have helped the party craft their upcoming paper on non-stun slaughter, halal and kosher banning. Beyond that, I mean... I can just vouch for the good character of the men running it, because they were basically all the groomsmen at my wedding, some of the men that we're also mutually fond of, you know, Harrison Pitt, Charlie Downs, etc. So, yeah, enthusiastic support.
Just one second, Connor. Harrison and Charlie are actually formally employed, aren't
yes.
they? By let me. I'm just trying to get it clear, and so our conversation, the contours will be clear too. Right, Connor. Can I now put a little tease to you? You know I'm terribly fond of teasing. Do you ever look at that curious ragbag of a thing called The New Statesman?
I do indeed. They actually put out some good stuff these days.
Yes. Did you see the, I thought, terribly mean-spirited piece on Rupert, the most recent one?
I don't think I did.
Ah, what is fascinating is it plays him up as old Tory duffer. There is a description of him, again, now let's get this right, how he could fall into that category. He was at Radley.
This angle is particularly interesting for Starkey to be going on. And this has actually this week, as I record this, come a little bit under the spotlight after the person who runs Restore's account put out an ill-considered boomery tweet, as it pertains to the Iran war. Let's see how that all plays out. But I do find it interesting that this is the angle of attack.
A member of a very distinguished St. James's Club. He is a farmer. He's a hunt and shoot and fisher. He's that marvellously vigorous reddish complexion of the English aristocrat who spends a lot of time outside killing things. But it's also linked to what I think was completely outrageous phrase of Rupert doddering round Westminster. Now, anybody who is less of a dodderer than Rupert with that vigorous stride and really powerful sort of punch, I couldn't think of. But the high Tory characterization is pretty right, isn't it?
Perhaps not philosophically, but in terms of his aesthetics as an aristocrat, yes.
Well, I mean, semi, you know, gentleman.
As
a gentleman. But isn't there a sense, if you look at his previous record as a member of the Conservative Party or so on, he would be, and many of his attitudes, his.
So what Starkey is doing here is actually similar to the tactics of Pimlico Journal and Jacques, which is basically to paint Rupert as basically just a Tory. Now Starkey is kind of going in on this angle. I understand why that's being done. The question for people to ask is whether this is actually true or not. And this is kind of an ongoing open question. Let's see what Connor says to this.
Paternalism, I would say, the literal paternalism in terms of how he thinks the wide range of the population should be treated. They do savour, don't they, of a particular strain of rather old-fashioned high Toryism.
Yeah, I would stress the old-fashioned there, David. And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, there was a piece that sounds similar to what you described that was mainly on Jimmy Goldsmith that had some commentary on Rupert in The New Statesman. And it notes that in 93, obviously, Goldsmith set up the referendum party to oppose John Major's attempt to drag us into the euro, which would have been disastrous. And Rupert was an early campaigner on that. And I think that's when he broke his formal association with the Tory party beyond allowing Rishi Sunak to attend Southampton FC football matches. So I think it's evident that the Tory party has lost its way in that if you want to describe Rupert as a kind of avatar of being an old Tory, a sort of aristocrat, farmer, someone who cares for the land, stewardship, speaks in terms of generational cycles, that there's no one really like him left in the Tory party now.
But can we just stick? So before we go on and rubbish the Tory party, which I'm wearing one of my hats, I'm perfectly happy to join in another one, I shall be a kind of slightly shy defender. Can we just stick with that characterization of Rupert as, okay, outside the Tory party?
See, this is kind of an interesting one because, I mean, having seen Rupert myself, I'm not sure if the characterization of him as an old-fashioned high Tory, it's got some of the aesthetics of it that he leans into occasionally, but it's difficult to square that with Randianism, kind of objectivist free market economics and some of his other stances. So, I mean, already I'm not quite sure how true these characterizations are of the Rupert that I've seen. But he does, nonetheless, it is true, have this paternalistic kind of strain in his character. And that is certainly true.
Quite old-fashioned high Tory. Now, what Rupert is doing at the moment, and we've gone through the trio of you, stalwart young men, as you were saying, groomsmen at your wedding, Harrison Pitt, Charlie Downs, you, this extraordinary crossover of age and youth. Now, Does it remind you of anything in the history of the Tory party?
Unless you're going to say the sort of youthful fervour around Margaret Thatcher in the...
There was an element of that. I think it goes back much further and into something much, much more explicit. Think of young.
Mm.
Think of the adjective and then put the...
Oh, what?
So he's going to talk about Pitt the Younger, I'm guessing.
William Pitt.
Well, it's actually not the Younger, no, that's a comparative. No, it's young England. It's that extraordinary movement of the 1830s, which, of course, Disraeli was a leading member of, which hovers on the borders of high Toryism and radicalism. Now, could I try the teasing idea that you are, what you lot online have made it, is a modern version of young England? There are immensely conservative elements and very radical ones. Isn't that a true? Isn't that a fair?
I recognise the characterisation of youthful exuberance, radicalism, but a sort of recovery of tradition. Mm-hmm. But I am very fond of your dinner speeches, Professor, especially the one that you gave at the Cromwell Club. I know that you frequently referenced Disraeli's rejoinder to rootless cosmopolitan liberal change for its own sake. And I would say, and after your interview with Rupert and one of your most recent appearances at a Reform Branch meeting, where you mentioned that quote again, I wrote a piece on Substack actually breaking down why I don't think Restore is connected to that dichotomy that Disraeli sets forward and you often cite. Because I think actually that puts the Tories, capital T Tories and the modern Conservatives, on the losing end of a dialectic. Because you don't have to accept, and I know that you don't accept this, but you don't...
I think Connor may, whether he knows it or not here, be have in mind the dialectic that I mentioned in the recent article on Fabianism and Tory, you know, and the Conservative Party, when I was, doing the back and forth with Pimlico, I talked about how the Fabians are one side of the dialectic and the Conservatives, Burke and conservatism, is simply the negative mirror. And I should remember I shared the essay of Roy Jenkins literally saying that the Conservatives are structurally necessary for the Fabians to do what they do. I think this is Connor more or less putting that thesis to Starkey. Let's see what he says.
You don't have to accept all change as inevitable, which the quote from Disraeli often does. Instead, there is a kind of third position, dare I say, which is the more reactionary position, which says, well, did that change need to happen? Is that change necessary? Is it inevitable? And can it be undone? And so, for example, when we're talking about migration, the modern Tory party says that we must adapt to the change that has happened. You know, they try and wash their hands of the culpability of it, but they say, okay, well, these people are, you know, they're here now, we're a mosaic of different cultures, and they insist on integration as a sort of fix-all. We've now got Kemi Badenoch proposing a national integration strategy, spearheaded by Robert Toombs, himself a learned historian. Rupert's response is, no, millions must go. Actually, the change was not necessary, we don't need to adapt it, and it can, in fact, be reversed. And so it's less whether the change itself is necessary. It's less whether the change itself can be rerouted to correspond to our traditions. It's less whether we accept that Britain itself is a progressive nation, even if we're progressing towards an undesirable destination. It's more, can we undo something? And I think that's encapsulated in the name Restore, rather than, you know, for example, Reform, which...
Interesting. Very interesting, and I don't necessarily disagree with anything Connor said there. Let's see how Starkey responds to this, because, I mean, it strikes me that to disagree with that puts the Conservatives or put the Tory always in the position of being the ratchet, you know, the ratchet for the, everybody's seen that meme of the ratchet effect. This is being put to Starkey now. Let's see if he's able to process it, and let's see if he's able to counter it.
Denotes the idea that we can adapt to the change, we can sort of save the system from itself. So I don't know if I necessarily agree with the Disraeli comparison, but I certainly agree with the revolutionary sort of fervour.
Yeah, I mean, what I was really trying to get at, and we'll come back to all those points that you made now, which where there's a lot of common ground between us, but equally, I think there are some points that that we need to discriminate, using a good old-fashioned word in a good old-fashioned sense, as opposed to its modern abused one. What I was really trying to tease out was, I listened to, I can't remember, which one of your splendid, and it was a very splendid performance at an NCF quite recently, in which the discussion shifted to a ground which is now very common, actually, between you and Reform, thanks in particular to Danny Kruger, the whole issue of family, community, country. And again, how that's understood, how it's applied is a different matter. But that's become very common ground. And you were giving, and this is where I wanted to tease out the idea of the neo-medieval. You were giving this account, and it was warmly echoed by so many people there, that when I grew up, I lived in a close-knit community, and I'm echoing directly what one of the speakers said. And when I went off to school, it wasn't just a question that I walked, it was that people who along the streets where I walked knew me. If anything had gone wrong, they would have known who to get in touch with. And it was this, dare I say, I think a world almost of England as a series of idealized medieval villages, wasn't it?
That sounds fair, but it's also in a very long tradition of viewing England. I have all these books by Sir Arthur Bryant here, where he very much echoes this. In fact, I'll show them. Yeah, there's the medieval foundation, and then he's got goes through English history, and this is very much. In that mold, that picture. Let's see how Connor responds.
I don't know about idealized, but possibly. And something we were discussing off air, you gave my your condolences, which I appreciate, for my grandmother's passing. It was her funeral yesterday. And my grandfather, I've said before, not on this platform, died on the same day as Peter Whittle. And, you know, it's very tragic for my family, but now they're reunited. And I went and spent time with them, and they were all born in the East End. Some of them still live there, some of them still suffering in the Roman Road in Newham, but you know, my grandparents born near Poplar and Dagenham and all that. And they've, you know, most of them been ethnically cleansed out of the area. And when I was reunited with them on that occasion of grief, there was an outpouring of solidarity, of shared understanding, and all of them echoed the same concerns about politics that, you know, you or I do now for a living. And so it reminded me that these people could be living around me. And it's only because of various economic and policy choices that we've been pried apart from our extended families. You know, we're more nuclearized than those in the Mediterranean, and for the better, I would say, in terms of our development. Alan McFarlane's work is good on that. But we are atomized from our extended communities and our extended families, and we should actually seek to reclaim that, because it's not.
Yeah, I think this is a kind of underrated point in general, and I think it comes home more when you start actually have kids yourself as well, which is that when you're raising a child, as I've been doing, kind of need, like, especially the mother needs a support network around her as well. And I'm not just talking about the husband, I'm talking about, you know, family, wider family. And that is one of those things that I think is under discussed in general as a one of the real consequences of atomization that Connor's talking about here.
It's not beyond the bounds of reasonableness that we could do that. It's not some sort of fictitious idealized past. It's still within reach. So I'd sort of dispute maybe the word idealized, but yeah, other than that, yes.
Can I tell you why I'm probing on this one? You see, it seems to me that you mentioned Alan Macfarlane, the fact that the English family is unusual in its early development towards a nuclear family, and so on. If I go back to my, let me give you my very, very contrary experience of all of this. I am, I think the best way of describing it, setting my politics aside, I am a rootless anywhere. My parents had moved in the Great Depression in the 1930s from Oldham, where they were part of a world exactly as you describe. The world of cotton, the world created by cotton, the world created by the little back-to-backs that clustered round the cotton mills and the weaving sheds, and the world of nonconformity, in the case of my parents, Quakerism, that developed round it. But that world collapsed. Essentially from 1929. My father was out of work from 31 to 35 and found a job not all that far away in Kendal in the Lake District. So I suppose you're 60-odd miles away, 60-odd miles or so north of Manchester. But it was a completely different world. We were offcomers, as you were brutally known there. We had no local connections. My father loved it because he loved solitariness and fell walking. My mother hated it. I grew up with absolutely no sense of local attachment whatever. And I grew up with ambition.
This is a very interesting bit of backstory. But of course, one way of passing all of this, and maybe Connor will talk about it, is that this is the result of nomadism. This is all the stuff Carlyle talked about, that it is, in fact, capitalism which has its way of uprooting people from where they're from and plonking them in situations where they don't know anyone. I mean, this is, if you go back far enough in most people's families, they'll have a story like this, because the Industrial Revolution and, quote-unquote, urbanization and the destruction of those medieval villages that Bryant talks about in the Dark Satanic Mills and all of that did actually do this to a lot of people. And this is something that so-called Anglo futurists and that type of crowd actually champions. They see it as quote unquote progress. They see it as a good thing. Whereas obviously the alternative view, you know, the Carlylean view says, well, it's nomadism and it's actually kind of bad. Kind of a bad development. Let's see where this goes. This is kind of very interesting backstory from Starkey here.
And I grew up with ambition to get out and cast the dust of the place off my feet. And in my school, my little...
And I have to say, I mean, I'll tell you this, given that these guys are opening up about their background. When I grew up, right, I've got fond memories of the town I grew up in, and I still go back there. I've just been back there. For a few days in Easter. When I was 15 or 16, I couldn't wait to get out. I was there listening to my Smiths and David Bowie, and I felt kind of trapped by this little town. I couldn't wait to get to university. I couldn't wait to go out there into the world. And still, that element of wanting to get out is a part of who I am and what I am like. And I've said before that even if you had the kind of medieval foundation style village or Trumpton, as I've talked about many times before, I guess the ideal for me is that I would just be like a kind of loner in that village, a slightly antisocial element in that village. What I've come to realize is that most people aren't like me. Most people are not like that. Some people are, but most people are not. And it is, you know, for the people who are not like me that I often have come to some of my conclusions. I should also mention that even back in those communities, you did have your outlier figures, okay? And in regardless of which traditional culture, you had your kind of shaman figures on the outside, or you had your kind of slightly unusual eccentrics and so on. This also existed as part of British life, but also as part of life wherever it manifested. So this is something that I am able to reconcile myself with that. The problem is, I'm glad I'm doing this because this is the sort of thing we never talk about. The problem is when somebody like me or when somebody like David Starkey sees our own experience as normative, as the rule for everybody. And it is not the rule for everybody. There's a reason why Starkey became an academic and I became an academic. Academics are weirdos. And we have to remember, you have to remember that, not see yourself as normative. Anyway, I rabbited on enough, but you get the point. Most people want a sense of belonging to something. They want a sense of belonging to something bigger, to something bigger than themselves, as Jonathan Haidt has talked about. And they also need and require guidance. And they seek out people to lead them. This took me a very long time to accept. I would characterize my entire 20s and even my early 30s, my kind of formative years as an intellectual, trying to resist this idea. And it was actually reading Jonathan Haidt that flipped this, got me to understand this point that I'm talking about. It's a very important book, that, The Righteous Mind by Haidt. Key to a lot of my ideas. Carlyle as well, and Encountering Evola and people like that also helped me understand it as well. But it is important to realize that in this frame, you have to accept that some people are different from other people, and those people who don't yearn for the community and so on are outliers. They are not the normative. You could not build a society of simply the eccentric or simply the person who's antisocial. Can't work. You need to have the sense of that belonging in that community. I know some people disagree that, like the vitalists, the Baptists and so on, they disagree with what I've said. Or even if they agree with it, they're like, well, we don't care about them. We only care about the exceptional person. And I guess this is where some of the quote-unquote paternalism may come in. You've got to look out for everybody. Anyway, let's carry on.
The local grammar school, long abolished, of course. There were plaques on the wall because it had been founded one way or another in 1526. And do you know why it had been founded, Connor? Partly to educate local lads, because, of course, it was only men at that point, but it was above all so that bright boys could get out. There was the entire network of scholarships developed in the 17th century, which, if I'd followed the rules, and as you know, I never follow rules, I was supposed to go to the Queen's College, Oxford, and instead failed to get into the Queen's College, Cambridge, and got my apostrophes the wrong way around. But I think
you see, the bright boys to get out. This is the thing. It's hard to, because the view is, you end up in a place which some people might call elitist. I don't say it's elitist. I just say it's recognizing that everybody has slightly different parts to play. Okay, and the issue is, why do you privilege, or why do you try to look at that path of the bright boy, quote unquote, as being the only one? If I was to say, where did Blair's Britain go wrong, or where has Britain gone wrong? It's trying to make that bright boy the rule as opposed to the exception. Ultimately, it's a problem of having a democratic mindset. Maybe Starkey will say this, but let's see.
You are, and this whole cult, Kruger, the whole of this communitarian route, I think you're missing what is peculiar in England, which is the mobility, which is the change, the embracement of change, the creativity. Again, I've given you one example of my family. If I look at the generation of my grandmother, whom I never knew on my mother's side, two of her sisters went to Canada. Half of my grandfather's family finished up in moving between Canada and New Zealand. We've been the country with the greatest levels of, not immigration, emigration. That's why the empire was created. And what I'm concerned about is that...
He's right that this is a fundamental aspect of what people call the Anglo or Britain as an island nation, that is at once the shire, but also the explorer and the adventurer who wants to get out. Okay, he is correct about that. There has to be a balance between the two. There has to be a way of giving those people the opportunity to do that without destroying the shire, without destroying all those other things, or without kind of doing it in such a way that you have to look down on the little guy. When I was growing up, right, becoming an electrician or a plumber or going to an apprenticeship or not going to university was really frowned on. It was looked down, like people turned their nose up at it. The idea of starting a family young, there was a taboo placed on it. And the fact is, so many people who ended up doing degrees and getting like your average 2.21 or 2.2 or whatever, frankly, went into a path that was not designed for them, that they should never have gone into. And now look at it, massive youth unemployment, graduate unemployment. Who could have predicted it? And this is the basic problem with this kind of leveling, egalitarian, you know, democratization of everything. Is that it wants to have a single rule for everybody. And in the process, it ends up destroying those things that make, they're special to many, many people. Let's see where this goes. I'm very interested. It is not that Starkey is wrong. Starkey is only telling like one half of the story here. A very good person on this is Joseph Schumpeter. In his book on the socialism and democracy and so on, he talks about how, yeah, England was able to do this stuff. It was able to industrialize. It was able to be the first real big capitalist nation. But it was only able to do that because it was feasting on the fumes of the medieval foundation. That medieval foundation that they started this interview with is absolutely crucial, because it gave the structure, the hierarchy, the kind of social bonds, the strength. But look how quickly it used them up. Look how quickly it destroyed them. And look how quickly it got us to the point that we are here. So I do take Starkey's point, and I relate to it in many, many ways, in the ways that I've just outlined. But it's only half the picture. Let's see. I'm very interested to see how Connor answers this. Probably we're not going to get through this whole interview, but I'm glad that we at least started it, because it's getting us into some very tricky territory here.
In this endeavour to address what's gone wrong here at home in Britain, we're embracing, as I said, a neo-village view of our past, whereas we were something very different. We were the society that creates modernity, that creates modern science. We're the society that creates modern industry, modern politics, except the politics aren't modern, they're very ancient. Do you see what I'm getting at? And I'm really concerned that we are producing, as I said, the fantasy of the 1830s, as opposed to what Disraeli does in the 1860s, which is to come up with a viable model by which the leading intellectuals, the rich, productive class, the shapers of the economy, of intelligence, or whatever, reach out and embrace the newly enfranchised, my ancestor, the skilled working class, in that extraordinary Disraelian coalition. Because
now I should say that the elite theorists did have this view that the best thing you can hope for is an aristocracy of the talents, that actually it's wise for the ruling class to give pathways for people, regardless of where they come from, to, you know, get out, as it were, as Starkey was talking about, and that actually some degree of openness to those people from other backgrounds is important. What's interesting to me here is that we're actually dealing with a scenario in which some of the talents, Connor included, and some of the lads at the Restore and so on, are actually being gatekept out by the managerial class, as represented by Matt Goodwin and all of that stuff that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. This is also interesting to me, and it's worth bearing that in mind as we go forward, because that may go missing as well. This is actually a very complex topic they're talking about. Very interesting.
Remember, what turns the Conservative Party into the gigantic electoral force that it was is the enfranchisement of the working class. So long as the mid-19th century franchise remained essentially a middle-class franchise, Toryism was always marginal. And you see what I'm trying to get at? I want a much more...
And you see that this does persist. Like sometimes when I'm arguing, or I say arguing, sometimes when I go back and forth with the missus on certain topics, she will default back to a kind of classist lens. She'll say, it was probably, you should get back down the mine, she'll say to me. She'll say it was kind of a mistake to give your lot education and things like that. So that it does actually exist, like the, and then I'm thinking, well, okay, all right, I can understand why, you know, I can understand some reflexive classism and so on and so forth, but then you have to think, well, okay, but, you know, the fact is that I have intelligence, that I've been able to study topics and write books and come up with sophisticated views on things, as has David Starkey here, as have many other people from a working class background, okay, or from a from a position of non-privilege, you might say, okay, and I do find it very difficult to reconcile that. So, you know, to that extent, I agree with the elite theorists that there have to be pathways in, but I also think that the view, if you go back and have a look at the medieval era as it existed, or of European history, is a little bit overstated, to which people were just kind of locked and unable to, you know, escape the village or escape the shire. You know, like Martin Luther, as one example, he kind of quote unquote got out. In fact, history is full of people who quote unquote got out, or, you know, who had talent or were able to work their way up. Charlemagne himself, the original emperor. Okay, so it is a little bit disingenuous to say that the system was completely locked off, you know, historically. There were pathways for exceptional men to rise up back then as well. Anyway, let's carry on.
More open, I want a much more ambitious. You know, the only way this country is going to survive in the world of great powers, in the overwhelming mechanic strength of China, is by a recovery of both the rootedness, which you talk about, and that extraordinary adventurousness. Remember, the wonderful phrase, of course, it's referring to the dead, you know, there is a corner of the foreign field that is forever England. Those men who went to Canada, those men who went to Australia, they made little Englands there, big Englands there. But they were brave, they were astonishing risk takers, and I'm feeling that we're missing this. The whole thing is terribly defensive.
Yeah, he's. I mean, the thing is, I don't think Rupert would disagree with anything he's saying here, having been a risk taker himself and an entrepreneur and a businessman and so on. And I understand. I'm sympathetic to what Starkey's saying on one level, with the caveats I mentioned. Fascinated to know what Connor's going to say. It's taken us 40 minutes to get through. You know, maybe I'll do a part two on this as well, depending on how people take this one.
And protective.
Allow me to gently disagree on 2 points. I don't disagree that there is an archetype of the sort of seafaring Anglo that goes out and settles the wilderness and builds, you know, the greatest naval power that we've ever seen, and you know, produce the Industrial Revolution and modern science and great literature. But just as in Tolkien's work, there is Gondor, there is also the Shire. And you don't actually get the Shire without Gondor protecting it. Completely agree. But what I think has been the problem of modern politics, and perhaps... You say, Dave, we need to sort of reclaim the sort of rootedness of, you know, the farmer, the village, etc. But that was sort of an addendum to your description, and it was, and I dare I be cheeky, a bit of a Whiggish description almost.
Terrible. Excuse me. I believe old Whiggism is real conservatism.
Of course. Well, yeah.
So there it is, Whiggism. Correct. Call him out, Connor, for Whiggishness, but still fascinated to know where he goes.
You're a Burkean. This is part of my my great disagreement. I think the Whigs and the Tories are actually caught in the same dialectic. But we'll park that for a second. I think that is inconsiderate of the people who, by temperament and by desire, are true somewheres. Like you know, I've travelled to, you know, Australia, America, Japan, etc. And I love plenty of those countries. Love many things about them. There are many things that are recognisable from home, because, you know, there are creations. But they're not the same as, you know, the robin singing at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the springtime and the narrow streets and things like that. I'm very much a rooted somewhere person. And what I think has happened in modern politics, in the pursuit of a sort of Max Weber style Protestant work ethic, it has eschewed all of those things that can't be registered on a spreadsheet, that can't be factored into our global standing. People that speak in terms of...
See, he's coming in with a bit of Carlylean analysis here. Good stuff, Connor. Let's see where Starkey comes back.
You know, what you chastise Jeremy Hunt for doing in your most recent excellent exchange, it pushes the somewhere people into an anywhere mould. And I didn't hear a lot of place for somewhere people in what you're saying. And I think part of the problem is...
Let's give Connor credit where it's due. A lot of people have been very harsh on Connor in the past. You know, and I had my criticisms as well. This was a fantastic answer from Connor. It's not like it's pushing the somewheres into an anywhere mold. You can write that down, make that into a slogan.
In being unwilling to accept the changes that have been inflicted upon us, what Restore is doing is trying to push for a place for those somewhere people in that consideration. And I actually reject the idea that Reform is doing that, because if you, I don't think I share basically any of Danny Kruger's politics. I'm going to tell you why. Danny Kruger thinks Afghans can be English. That is an immediate disqualifier for saying that you are a somewhere person, because if you're not conserving the demographics of the very nation that you're seeking to conserve, you're actually not conserving anything. Again, you're
okay. They've gone straight into the demographic issue here, but his initial response was very good. Let's see where this goes now.
Basically, a Whig that says through institutions, through culture, through like osmosis, people from a completely different place, ancestry, cultural frame of reference can just sort of become one of us. And I just don't agree that that's the case. And I think that's a very somewhere, it's very anywhere view inflicted onto the somewheres who, until now, have been voting for a party like Reform because they want somewhere representation. So I think Restore actually exists to give the somewheres representation.
But in order that the somewheres can survive, we do need, as I said, to combine it, as historically it always was combined. And it seems to me that the Disraeli Conservative Party manages remarkably. Of course, you have the vehicle of empire, which holds these two things together in exactly the way that I was talking about. And I again, it's this is really gentle advice as much as anything else. Because, as you know, I'm old fool enough to believe that the right does really have more in common than that that divides it, and that it will have to reunite. But it does seem to me, and if one looks at the dynamism of Rupert's own career, if I frankly look at all you lot, if I dare be so vulgar as to call you that, you're not sit on the bottom chaps at all. You're quite the opposite, and we need.
See, it's a little bit disingenuous to say that somewhere people, as they're calling them, are sit on the bottom chaps. Right, that anybody with any get up and go or drive is an anywhere person. This is also a false dichotomy, and I hope Connor picks up on that. But let's see where this goes.
Need, in other words, to recover a language which is both able to embrace dynamism on what was, after all, the traditional dynamism of England, and without which it will not survive. But at the same time, recognize that the dynamism requires roots. You see, my own view is, again, if we take the David Goodhart phrase, the somewheres and the anywheres, at the moment they are presented as in direct opposition and apposition to each other. I think traditionally in England they weren't. That, again, if you look at the proper Burkean view and my view, is that the old is the groundspring of the new. That amazing phrase of Chaucer right at the beginning of this extraordinary adventure of England and Englishness, where he, confronted with the new learning of the Renaissance, he puts it so wonderfully, you know, just as each year out of the cold dead ground comes forth new corn, so from old books new science springs. And I think we need, what I'm saying is, I think we need a different language, that rather than seeing those two things as opposition, I mean remember that great adventurism that we were talking about.
The problem is that I think that what we're dealing with is people's, you know, the natural disposition of certain individuals, so if you want to put it that way. Pareto talked about sentiments, the type one and the type two individual person, okay? And obviously Connor's talking about the type twos, okay? Starkey now is trying to find a way to, you know, reconcile that. I wonder if they can be reconciled, though, as disposition, because what we're talking about is something that is almost like pre-logical, pre-verbal even, you know, it exists, you know, disposition is the right word, or sentiments, as Pareto said, something very deep down in what a person is. And I don't know if you can do much about that. You know, I mean, look, as I said already, on the spectrum, I'm definitely an anywhere person and not a somewhere person. Okay, I could easily move to New York or Tokyo or anywhere else and do what I do here. You know, I've obviously, you know, and there are things that keep me from doing that, like having a family and so on. But if I was on my own, I could go anywhere. I could literally go anywhere, and I could make it anywhere too. This is the definition of an anywhere person. What accounts for that? It's disposition. First and foremost. Now, there are other elements to it as well. There are other elements to, you know, even within anywhere people, you can get people who are naturally optimistic and, you know, naturally more pessimistic and so on, which then may dictate, you know, whether you're going to be a rightist or a leftist or all that sort of stuff. But I wonder if these two things can be just kind of fudged in the way that Starkey's talking about. Let's see where we go.
The people who cross continents, who are in circumstances we cannot begin to envisage in the early 17th century, sailed to that barren wilderness, as it seemed at the time, of North America. What did they do when they got there? They created New England. And they carried with them a dynamic of old England and did completely extraordinary things with it, some of which revolters, like the Salem witch trials, others of which are astonishing. In that triumph of North America. And it's that combination. And again, it's what Disraeli, I think, was trying to get at in that famous quotation of 1867 and 1872, that it's not opposition to change, it's the sort of change, the understanding of an idea of a progressive country. But again, you will forgive the teasing, because I think it is an important one. You've forgotten there was a thing called Young England, that it was neo-medieval. Again, you see, and here again, you tell me to shut up if I'm being too personal, your embrace of Catholicism. Now, Catholicism was played around within the 1830s. This is, after all, just after Catholic emancipation. But in terms of the England from the 1500s, it is fundamentally an alien tradition, isn't it? And there is nothing, in one sense, more un-English than Catholicism.
Or I would say Islam.
yes, I would say that too.
David, that is shot through reform. It's an intractable problem. I mean, there's plenty to address in what you said, but I'm happy to sort of duke it out.
You know, I mean, I would also, I mean, you know, I'm not Catholic. I did go to a Catholic school, but to say that it's fundamentally un-English, I mean, up until Henry VIII and Edward VI and so on. It wasn't un-English, but you know, before. So I don't know why are we then taking our cue from Tudor England as opposed to, you know, Chaucer's England. You just mentioned Chaucer. I mean, Chaucer was a Catholic. Everybody in Richard II's England was Catholic. So yeah, again, let's see if, I mean, we'll see where this goes, but there's two different ways of looking at it, I would suggest.
A transubstantiation, or you know, loyalty to the state of Rome, but there are pretty much every other party has foreign faiths and their interests run through it, and so there is actually things less English than the concerns of the chaps that are running Restore. But in terms of your previous point about a lot of that change that was underwent during the 18th, 19th. Some of the good change that happened in the 20th century, not a whole lot of it. That was when, as you said to Jeremy Hunt, we were a hegemon. And that was during the period where there were frontiers. Now, the change that, let's use reform as the example, because you said, you know, the right has a lot more in common than it understands. The change they want to bring about seems to be subordinating our national interest, insofar as there is one, to other nations' national interests. I mean, Richard Tice was just on Saudi state-owned TV a couple of weeks ago saying that, regards to the Iran war, we should be prepared to do whatever the US and Israel think is best. No.
Interesting that we're getting into this territory. Let's see where this goes.
No, we should be prepared to do whatever we think is best. Farage is banning the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, a measure I support, by the way. But that's after meeting with the heads of the Emirates in order to attract better business investment. I know for a fact that Nadim Zahawi jumped ship to Reform UK because he got wind of that policy and thought it was going to be better for his business dealings. And they were going to appoint him, a first-generation Iraqi Kurdish immigrant, as the foreign affairs spokesperson, but they backed off of it because they thought it would be too contentious for their own base. I don't see how what they're doing is in any way corresponding with what I think is suitable, you know, representative of what the right should do. Whether or not it's in the national interest, whether it's, you know, adapting to change in a way that befits our traditions. And finally, the only other thing I would say is, it's not just that, as you said, okay, let's take Burke's definition. It needs to be rooted in something. It needs to be rooted in tradition, which is particular to a people and a set of virtues and customs that they find correspond to them. I don't think that we should allow Zia Yusuf and Nigel Farage admitting to calling the police on Rupert for bogus reasons to go unpunished. Because I don't think we actually have that much in common if we don't have basic virtues like loyalty and honesty, the sort of the cornerstones of conservative thought that Jonathan Haidt has found in his Moral Foundations. I don't think we can let that go, and I don't think we have much in common if they don't have that in common with us. So I'm very happy to talk about, you know, I listen to all your stuff, David. You know, the history, philosophy, you know, probing me on why I'm a Catholic versus not an English Shintoist, as you once have told me. It's all very good. But I think it talks past the point of the concrete personnel and policies within the factions of the right are just irreconcilably different.
I hope you're wrong, but can I just, again, and I wasn't actually trying to make a personal point at all.
No.
I was using you as an example. I mean, if we look at why Catholicism has shifted from something profoundly mistrusted, remember, even at the beginning of the 20th century, a public Episcopal Catholic procession in canonicals aroused the then Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith, to denounce this wicked, foreign, preposterous, idolatrous, and he actually uses the word idolatrous. You know, this is a liberal. This is the liberal. What I think is, and why I think it's worth putting Islam and Catholicism in the same sentence, for the very...
Huh? We're going to go here now? Well, I wasn't expecting it to go here. All right, let's see. Islam and Catholicism in the same sentence, okay?
Good reason. But remember, Catholicism was readmitted to England, onto Britain, on sufferance. It had been associated from the 16th century onwards with foreign domination, with terrorism, with a system of international religiously shaped legislation which claimed dominance over the secular sphere. In other words, there are very, very striking parallels with so-called Islamism, if not with actual Islam. Like you, I would actually argue it's actual Islam rather than this invented thing called Islamism. So why I think that even the echoes from the UAE, which you were talking about, I don't know whether you remember, I don't think you were there. It was the first ARC conference where I was a very reluctant attender because that sort of stuff isn't really me at all.
I'm glad you were reluctant, David. I wouldn't be seen dead at ARC, of course. I was asked to go, but fuck that.
But I found myself in one of those vast lobbies of the International Conference Centre, chased by a group of young men, all of whom were wearing tea towels, to be photographed with them. It was one of the funniest and strangest events of my life, because, of course, they represent that fundamental Erastian tradition of the various Arab monarchies in which Islam is firmly under the control of the state. And you have rigorous supervision of the choices of imams, of the particular shades of Islam, which are acceptable. And I wonder if we should, because even in the various definitions that you've been using, there are communities here which are settled, have full citizen rights and whatever, whether in fact the model that was used as part of that process of the domestication of Catholicism, so that by the time you're into the 19th and more particularly the early 20th century, the whiff of sulfur, the literal whiff of dynamite of Guy Fawkes, and well, it was real. It was real.
I know, I'm rather fond of it.
yes, but I'm sure you are. But if it was real and it was profoundly hostile to a Protestant state and the Protestantism had become a fundamental part of its new politics and it protected itself. It protected itself generally without persecution.
Is he going to try to use this as an argument for bringing Islam in the same way that Catholicism was brought in and Judaism was brought in, in the 19th century. Is he going to go here, I think? This is basically where Starkey's going, unless I'm mistaken.
option, but simply with the limitation of clergy and the limitation of the importation of legislation. And you see, one of the points that I want us to think about very seriously is, where do we get our ideas for this future world, this reconstruction, this restoration, this reform, whatever it is we're talking about? In practice, they can only be historical. And it seems to me that, remember, our failures are very recent. Our long-standing history is one of extraordinarily consistent success, which suggests that we addressed many problems correctly over long stretches of time. And religious diversity, a religious faith, which had acquired powerful and destructive political overtones, was re-domesticated.
Can I pause there, David?
Now, I wonder if Connor's going to say, how comes the narrative of success started changing when this domestication took place? I wonder if he's going to go there, but let's see. Because that would be one way to take the argument. Okay, let's carry on.
Because I think when this argument is made, and it's made by people that I have far less respect for, like Fraser Nelson or Dan Hannan, the conflation is always between religions. Whereas religion itself is a sort of continental European Protestant formulation in the 19th century that tried to get, as you said, Catholics, Protestants, some Jews spattered about here and there, to all get along. And it's because they had a common foundation to appeal to, which is the Bible. They had things in common such as the Ten Commandments, the belief in Imago Dei, they had the same doctrine of creation. Between Christian sects, they had the same doctrine of redemption, repentance, the belief in the incarnation, the resurrection, and the day of judgment. You need that fundamental foundation to appeal to in order to have some sort of accord over matters of politics or ecclesiastical politics. There is nothing in common beyond saying there is one God, and then when you probe beyond that, saying which God, they have different names for it, different books. There is nothing in common that, for example, Christianity has with Islam, less so things like Hinduism and Sikhism. And so the idea that there can be some sort of one overculture, one governing structure that can appeal to some sort of shared value that all of these religions have to get them to rub shoulders and get along, I think misses the forest for the trees, because values are created by religions, which are then spawned from the tribes that either invent or...
So I'm not sure, as a perennialist as I am, not sure if I agree with this point. This is where actual kind of religious faith comes into it, I guess. But as a perennialist, I'm not entirely convinced by this view. I'm also not convinced by the view that values come from religion. He quoted Jonathan Haidt earlier on. Jonathan Haidt basically says that those six moral foundations exist in every culture. So this is possibly a fundamental disagreement between myself and Connor. I happen to believe that the God is all the same, that there's only one God and people find it in different ways. This is the influence of Evola and people and perennial traditionalism on my thought. But I'm not sure if I agree with that. I also have a controversial essay called Religion as a Non-Factor in the Fate of Civilizations, which people can go back and have a look at. I often think that regardless of what the religion happens to be, that the fundamental character of the people underneath will find a way to express itself no matter what. And again, there are many, many different examples, whether you're looking at Haitians practicing voodoo, right, or the different experiences of, for example, the Persians under Islam and various Arab countries under Islam, quote unquote, or even the different ways that Shia Islam and Sunni Islam have gone. and many other examples. So yeah, this is one where obviously I'm going to have a different view from a doctrinal Catholic.
Adopt them. And I don't see how, for example, let's take Islam, because that's the one we've been focusing on. I don't see how Islam, which co-opts the Christian tradition to try and convert Christians in 7th century, you know, what was then Syria, and then says, oh, by the way, on Judgment Day, Jesus is going to come back, renounce Christianity, say submit to Allah, break the cross, abolish the jizya, and say, you know, once all the Jews have been killed on Judgment Day's there, like, all the Muslims are right all along and the Christians should fold themselves in. While the Quran and the Hadith say, you know, behead Christians and subject the unbelievers to the jizya and treat them like dhimmis in their own lands. I don't see how there's something to appeal to there. And especially when, if you don't have the same doctrine as Imago Dei, right, the innocent human person has inalienable value, which is codified, if you want to say, in secular fashion, in British documents like the Bill of Rights, like the Magna Carta, like Blackstone's formulation. They have biblical foundations, but they're also our English prejudices, our history. Islam doesn't have any of that. Muslim countries don't have any of that, by either historical tradition or scripture. And so I don't see how you appeal to that. And I also don't see why, and this has been my long-standing debate with Catherine Burblesing, why we should have to make concessions to our own identity to encompass its antonyms when there has been no democratic consent for mass migration or multiculturalism. And her response has always been, well, it's happened, so we have to work with it. Almost in, you know, Burkean fashion. A change has happened, and we have to reroute it back to our traditions. And I would just say, actually, this change can be undone. Whether or not they're settled, and here's where I'm not speaking for Restore, I just want to reiterate that, whether or not they're settled, the Home Secretary possesses executive powers to strip citizenship. Like, everyone's calling to do it for El Fattah. Everyone's supporting it for Shamima Begum. Why not for everyone that thinks like them, that acts like them, that has stolen parts of our country from us? Like, why should we have to accept and pay for and accommodate that change by marshalling the state, by redefining our identity, and by trying to reinterpret our own history to encompass traditions that have no correspondence with it? Me and a lot of young men are just going, sorry, we just don't want to accept this.
Can I just take, you began there by saying that the reason that it was possible to accommodate varieties of Christianity, and you slipped in rather awkwardly, and some Jews, in a commonality, was shared religious texts, clearly the Bible and the doctrines derived from them. I would suggest it was very, the basis was a different one. It's the essential privatization of religion, that religion is increasingly shifted to the private sphere. And you are allowed, indeed, to invoke religion. And again, I look at my own ancestors, Quakers, powerfully driven by their very peculiar, indeed, their extreme, in some ways extreme form, in every sense of the word, extreme form of Christianity, into notable political interventions. But it was done on the basis of working through the political system, not to undo the political system. But they remember so much prison reform, so much social reform, the entire activities, many of which I actually...
All right, well, we've been going an hour and 10 minutes here. This is a very interesting area. If people want a part two, maybe I will actually do the part two on this one. We're 40 minutes in to their conversation. And again, I don't agree with everything Connor said. I don't disagree with everything that Dr. Starkey said. But it's very interesting that this conversation is actually taking place, and quite refreshing, actually, that it's happening. I'll just remind everyone, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, Trivium, the bestseller, of course. Buy it now. And, I'd be interested to know. This has kind of made me think about some foundational things as well. Worth having these sorts of things out, I think. Join me again soon, and fascinated to see the comments on this one. Lots of quite difficult terrain covered in that 40 minutes, and maybe we'll come back for the second 20 minutes as well. I didn't think it was worth going back to Jeremy Hunt. maybe coming back to this may actually be worth it when all is said and done. All right, bye all.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.